Are you passionate about making a difference through design? Join us at the Human Centered Design Network's Circle, a new private community for changemakers just like you. Connect with like-minded professionals, gain exclusive rights to monthly learning opportunities, and lead the change in human-centered design. For more information, see thisishcd.com. Now, let's get back into that episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Doing Design Podcast on This Is HCD, hosted by all the world's best live design and innovation trainers from thisisdoing.com. In this podcast, we'll speak about all the behind-the-scenes things related to actually doing innovation and design within organizations. So we'll cover topics that include design research, service design, user experience design, content design, product management, and much, much more. In this episode, you'll hear from myself, Jerry Scullion. I'm a service designer first and foremost, but also the founder of This Is HCD and also the CEO of This Is Doing. And joining me in this episode is Adam Lawrence, part of the This Is Doing team and someone I hugely respect both as a human being and as a practitioner. I always walk away from any conversation with Adam or session learning something new from him. And interestingly, I asked Adam at the start of this episode how he describes himself, to which he responds, it's all about bringing people together, really. And at its core, that's kind of what we do in a day-to-day job. We bring people together to tackle complexity and move the dial forward, hopefully. But how do we do this in the current world we find ourselves in, when Zoom and Mural sessions have replaced the studio spaces for workshop facilitation? We speak about what we are doing to help alleviate some of the known issues within these digital experiences, and speak about the blurry edges of the experiences that we as practitioners should be aware of and try to address when designing online facilitation experiences. Let's get into the episode. A very warm welcome to Doing Design. I'm delighted to have you here. How are you?
I'm very well this morning. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
We were literally just mid-chat there, and I was asking, how do you frame what you do?
I've never actually thought about that. It's a really good question. People ask me, what am I doing? I normally say I'm helping people get stuff done. So I guess that's facilitation in a classical sense. And looking back on what I've done over my life, background psychology originally, and then marketing back in the days when marketing was king, you know, when it was all the P's, not just promotion, but it was deciding what to make and what price it should be at. So in that day, I worked in a large automotive company, and it was about connecting different mindsets, different cultures, the Japanese and European culture, not understanding each other, and then engineering and marketing, not understanding each other, and trying to just help people, almost being a translator between these different parts of the organization. I was very junior at the time, but that's kind of where I saw my usefulness. And then, as many folks know, I spent most of my life working in theater, usually interactive theater, improvised theater, some straight stage stuff as well. But what really fascinates me about the theatrical world is not so much the stage, not so much the user interface of the theater, if you like, but the back end, the processor. Yeah, so what's happening? How do a bunch of people who are very dissimilar in their worldviews and in their skills, whether that's the director and the actors and the musicians or the technical people, the stage designers or the front of house and the marketing, this large organization. I mean, the City Theater here in Nuremberg, the State Theater, is about 500 people work there. It's a big thing, and only about 50 are actually on stage. So you see the balance of that. And I was very interested in how they collaborate to make something work, to bring out shows every 8 weeks or so on time, in budget, and to do that with people with such different worldviews. I mean, if you talk to a German master electrician who's running the stage lighting, you know, is about the most down-to-earth person you could imagine, but they're producing great art, you know, and how does that happen? That's why I found the theater really, really interesting as a system. And the rehearsal room is what interests me. How do these people work together in a very practical way? They often find they can't work through language. They work through model making. They work through rehearsal. They work through stacks of information that the dramaturg puts together, and you sort of read the implicit information in there as much as the explicit information. It's a fascinating collaboration part.
Yeah. How do you compare the theater world to service design? There's a deep connection, and a lot of the service design of merit have really played on that whole kind of theater, like orchestrating experiences. It's a very similar world.
Front stage, backstage, all these terms come through it. Yeah.
And my background as a musician, I totally relate to what you're talking
about. Absolutely. Well, what fascinates me about it, I mean, if you think about it, there's a bit of a me moment here, but psychology is where I started off, then this marketing role that shifted more into planning what was going to be built. So product planning, production planning, and from there into theater. And at some point I look back on all that and I thought these are the same thing. And I don't mean that in a metaphorical sense. I mean that literally the same thing. What you've got is you are using something very, very practical to make people feel a certain way. Yeah. You might be using, if you're a therapeutic psychologist, you might use words to help someone explore their feelings. If you're a marketer doing promotion, you might use images and words to make someone want to buy something. If you're making a motorcycle, using gasoline and steel and rubber to make somebody go, as they scream down the motorway, with a flat four screaming its head off. Or if you're on stage, you're moving people through space and using things like music and light and of course, the words to make the audience want to put down probably quite a lot of money to be there, And all of these are intensely practical. You can't get away with a PowerPoint deck. You actually have to put the bike on the road. You actually have to put the show on stage on that date at that time. And if we say 9 o'clock, we mean 9 o'clock, not 1 minute past. And that's really a very interesting, pragmatic world that I like working in.
It's funny you say that. You see them as exactly the same thing. I did an episode recently on This Is Hate City with Rafa Sardino, who's this Grammy, 16 or 15 Grammy award-winning producer in America.
Wow.
I see the same. I see design and music is the same thing. Mm. And I've always thought it. And it wasn't until I had dinner with Mark, actually, in Dublin earlier this year, and I was chatting about it. I said, look, I can't separate the two. Music is exactly the same as design for me. The process of going into a studio with an idea for a song and iterating. What was really interesting when I spoke to Rafa Sardina recently was how the industry has evolved and technology has intercepted and reshaped how that process happens and how they validate the music to select the hits. I was like, and how it's ultimately kind of resulted in this generic pile of, I don't want to say this shit word, but I was going to say it, it's blandness, all the same stuff, because they're missing a lot of the face-to-face interaction with the audience, and a lot of the magic has been removed from the process.
This is always a danger, isn't it? I mean, I talk about all those things, theater, service design, making motorcycles or whatever, as the craftspersonship, the handicraft of emotion. This is how I actually make somebody feel a certain way. And a craftsman has tools. And tools evolve. So, okay, you and I are doing this through a video link, which is fantastic. So I'm going to come to Ireland to do it with you. But on the other hand, it does change our interaction. As we said before, I don't know if you exist from the waist down. You could be some kind of Dalek figure.
Careful.
Exactly. This is really interesting because I think that facilitation for me is the key skill of a service designer. I think Sarah Drummond, that brilliant woman, says that the material of a service designer is the organization. That's the stuff that we mold and work with. Yeah, exactly. And so the way that you influence that fabric is through facilitating groups of people or conversations. Facilitation for me is extremely physical. There is so much that happens because of the way you move in the room, how far away you stand from somebody, whether somebody breathes now or they breathe now, these things are the richness of our communication comes through that. Now, it's not just the words. We know this. I don't want to misuse Mehrabian again, but, this idea that people respond to you positively, mostly because of your body language and the way you say things more than the things you actually say. So this, of course, gets very interesting when you are reduced to a 20 by 20 centimeter square. where I can't smell you, literally can't smell you. We know there's actually quite a lot of chemical communication between human beings. Yeah. And I certainly can't see if your foot is twitching because you're impatient. You could be
those
smiling.
Signals are gone.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they're all part and parcel of trying to build trust. So showing how you actually understand the person and showing if you're actually somebody that you can actually build rapport with.
Which is so important. Yeah, because if when we're doing design, so when we're collaboratively designing a service design project or whatever with various parts of an organization, we're taking a lot of those people into scary places. Yeah? Because people identify themselves through their skills, through their knowledge, through their decision-making capabilities and things like that. And then we come along and say, well, yeah, but you know, your knowledge is retrospective. We make decisions by prototyping now, not by asking smart people, et cetera, et cetera. So we really challenge people's identity. Yeah. And they've got great tools that are working really well for them most of the time. So that idea of trust and what we say in theater and in facilitation, in my school of facilitation, is safe space. Yeah. That physical and mental context in which it's okay to mess up. Yeah. Which mess up is actually seen as useful is very, very important and not easy to create. In most companies, if you mess up, there's a meeting.
Yeah.
And that's not the case in design.
Those little nuances of facial expressions are lost. Mm. You know, like, I mean, I remember famously doing a workshop, famously for me, not for actually the whole world, I should point out. But in Australia, I did a workshop with a lot of social workers. And what I was proposing, I was able to read the room because I was there physically and I could sense something was shifting. And at the coffee break, I took a few of them aside and said, hey, can I validate what I'm seeing here? I said, there's something going on. And they go, are you trying to make us redundant? Is this going to make us redundant? Am I going to lose my job? And I'm like, absolutely not. That's not my intention here. My intention here is to bring everyone together to look at this problem and really try and understand it better and come up with some sort of like plan that we can work collaboratively. Mm. And they're like, oh, okay. Mm. If that had been removed and if this was all digital, I wouldn't have been able to, like, I may have, but like the chances are of me to have to detect.
Side conversations are so hard on this. A group of people in the Zoom, it's really hard just to say, that, hey, did you notice that? You have to like go into a breakout and have to make a big thing of it. It's difficult.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. There's a lovely story that Mark Stickdorn shared with me about costume. Yeah. So let's think about costume. I tend to work in a suit. Yeah. That's a decision that we've made because our methods are quite playful and quite odd looking, and it doesn't hurt to look conservative while you do these things. But Mark spoke of a situation where he was in an organization and doing research with the people there, and his team chose to dress very casually and dress like the people in the organization did. And that made a huge difference because what this company had was a situation where normally once a year consultants come in.
Yeah.
Consultants in quotation marks, you know, guys in suits walk around with a clipboard, and 2 months later, someone gets fired. And that is people's experience of having visiting experts in the organization. It normally leads to rationalization and a misuse of the word lean, and people lose their jobs.
Yeah. I've been on that side of things as well, where the person coming around with the clipboard and says, can I ask you, I just want to check this process here. Mm. I'm like, oh, come on. Like, what are you trying to do? So I've had that experience, but also I use dress as well when I go into organizations. If I'm researching, I try to dress down as opposed to dressing up. And it's such an important tool as part of our craft. But I'm obviously wearing a t-shirt here today and you're wearing a polo shirt. But it changes depending on who I'm working with and how I want to be perceived.
And it also changes the way you feel about yourself as well. That power dressing thing. But sometimes, or you can take off your armor and be a little bit more human.
I feel much more comfortable. I'm going to take out my shoulder pads.
yeah, power dressing in the 80s. Yeah,
so. Those were the days, man. Let's go back to that.
The hairspray. Oh, goodness.
So chatting about facilitation, and we've both done a lot of facilitation workshops in person, but how are you finding the kind of shift to 95% all online? Because I know you do a little bit still in person, but
sure.
It's a select group.
Yeah.
Well, what are the things that you're struggling with yourself?
I've got to admit, I was quite vehemently anti-online before this, and I still much prefer doing stuff in person. I'm going to be honest about that. But I've been quite surprised how well many things work, how some things work better online. But what I worry about is the gaps between, because This is one of my sort of little my little campaigns I'm trying to push through my life. I'm trying to get designers, service designers, to stop thinking in workshops. Yeah, because 95% of our work happens outside workshops, and that's really important to acknowledge that it's not everything is a sprint. Yeah, and of course, when we are doing more and more stuff online, it tends to, you know, focus our attention more on those very, let's say, structured interventions of a workshop type, where you run a session, you run a tool with people and so on, because you can't have the conversation in the corridor afterwards. It's probably just as important as the actual session itself. Yeah. You can't sit beside somebody while they're starting to implement the things you've been talking about, or move your desk there for a week and just see what's going on. It all happens through very conscious, framed interventions or conversations, and we're sort of losing that in between. And this worries me quite a lot. It worries me generally because people are saying, oh, we don't need offices and so on because the work is happening really well through video. Yes, the work happens pretty well through video, but work is not the only thing that happens in the office. There's so much social capital as well, and there's so much implicit and underground communication going on, which I think is the actual, it's more than just the lubricant. It's actually a lot of the value that we create in our organizations comes through that. Yeah. And if we focus on only on getting the job done, I think quite soon we're going to find that more and more difficult.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, you know, we've become more robot-like, I guess, in the last 6 months than we've ever become. And we're just on a process. Like people are just being applied to a process to get a job done.
Yes.
So how will that transfer into staff churn? And
exactly.
We're suddenly very replaceable.
We are. And we're also all quite worried of hanging on to our jobs and trying not to be the one who makes too much noise about it and so on, because many people are in difficult financial situations and it's an interesting time. I mean, in terms of the actual work of facilitation, a lot of my thinking is around how do we make that stuff that happens beside the actual project. Yeah. Let's call it the edges. Yeah. Those soft edges where all these interesting things happen. Yeah. How do we get them into a Zoom call, for example? You know,
yeah.
So it can be a little thing like, for example, not using the waiting room, but just being there a bit early. And when folks rock up, they rock up and you start having a chat with them. And as other ones come in, and even if you're still getting your PowerPoint together, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But if you have that moment where, you know, at 9 o'clock, the waiting room opens and everyone comes in simultaneously, it's automatically anonymizing. 20 faces show up at once. Okay. They're just faces. And it's fine if some people show up a little bit towards the end, but I've had conversations with at least a few folks before it goes off. And at the end, a soft close. Who wants to hang out? You know, who wants to come back later on? And we often offer, we have these open space sessions we run quite a lot at the Co-Creation School with my friend Renata Sergenrad and Anna-Kira Beksch, where we just have an sort of open house a couple of times a month. And people just rock up, and there it's easy to go into a little room and have a one-on-one conversation if you want to.
Yeah. It's funny, just when you look at those kind of the hard lines being more blurred lines.
Yeah.
With it, I'm not trying to quote Robin Thicke, but like those blurred lines are really important. Yes. And especially when you do design research, like my background is primarily in research and design research. Many of the most important conversations are had on exit, whenever they've left the room and I'm walking them back to their car.
Yep.
And too often they're like, what was that about? You know, are they really going to try and build that?
Yeah.
What were you trying to get out of me? And I'm like,
exactly.
And that's lost. That's gone.
It is.
And, you know, so how do it'd we be get really that? Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do we do that online? Like, and I don't think it's impossible, but, you know, I was out walking. I walked my kids to daycare this morning. And suddenly other sort of methods for research online are going to become a lot more important. Stuff like mobile ethnography and all those different disciplines that give us more broader understanding of the problems that we're trying to research, but it'll take longer to sense make and it'll take longer to get those really rich insights. And businesses need to be prepared for that, because on the other hand, if we're treating everything like a process, then it's just like 5 days for this, 3 days for that. Research is going to take longer, and it's not going to be a very much like in and out. It's going to be a more effort. It's going to be much harder.
And the difficulty around that is that a lot of organizations don't really get research anyway. And they want to have, I guess, quite digital information. What are the numbers? What are the facts and so on? Quantitative stuff, or very clear A connects to B type statements. Yeah. And you and I know that an awful lot of the most important stuff in research and design generally is implicit. Yeah. It's, you can't actually express it in words, and certainly not in numbers.
Yeah.
Or you'd need to write a novel or a play to express it. You can't put it into a sentence. Yeah. So that stuff gets carried through projects in those little conversations in between, certainly in the form of prototypes that can embody things that you can't say, and in terms of tone of voice and things like this. And with the sort of the square edge of your screen making such a sharp division between, you know, work and not work now, it's going to be challenging to find out ways to keep that important implicit side of design going.
So what's working well? Let's talk, because I thought Sarah Drummond, I mean, unbelievable. Every time I open up Twitter, it's like Gandalf the Wise.
Yeah.
It's like, it usually encapsulates what I've been thinking in some form, but she does it much, much better. And there's Mural, and there's Miro, there's Zoom, Hangout, Skype, which we don't hear too much of Skype, actually. Let's do a Skype session anymore. It's all a Zoom call. Mm-hmm. But all these great tools, how are you using them to get what you need to get done?
Yeah, so our standard setup is going to be an online whiteboard. Personally, I've found Mural and Miro both to be very good. And a Zoom call is my preferred channel. I do like breakout rooms, and they're very important. I do like gallery view. We can see everybody, and these things don't always work in some of the other offerings out there. Of course, you have to use what the client's using.
Yeah.
But as you say, yeah, some of it is working really well. So let's think about what the upsides are of this. For certain people, a sort of happy, jumpy, bouncy workshop room is a horrible place to be. Yeah?
Yeah.
People have more introvert preferences. Yeah. Can feel uncomfortable in that space. So the possibility to just type something into a chat window and send it into the middle of the room, yeah, is actually very useful. And if you think about the times in, let's imagine a workshop where you have several teams in the same space, or you split the team to work on different aspects, and you go around the room and you ask them to sort of, where are you guys right now? Where are you guys right now? Where are you guys right now? One, that takes quite a while. Yeah. And two, again, the loudmouth people will dominate that. The extrovert alpha types will dominate that. Where you say, okay, everyone put your latest insight into the chat window or drop it onto the board. Boom. Yeah. That takes a second. And we have a much more, equal volume of voice from different people.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting to how these channels can help us engage the people who are not the usual suspects, the ones who love a nice noisy workshop and want to be in front of the flip chart the whole time telling people what they think.
There is a little bit of the whole, you know, the digital footprint. If you say something wrong online, it can be screen grabbed and it can be used against you in future. Yes. Whereas in that safe and brave room that we all try and cultivate and create when we're doing real world workshops.
Yeah.
I find that space is something that scares me the most.
Yes, it is.
The people in the organizations who have got so much to offer, they're like, I'm not putting anything online because HR can see this. And it goes back to the trust thing. I'm like, how do you ensure them that what they put in there, they can take back out and it's not going to be used against them and so forth. It's those bits that don't get discussed enough. And
they don't. It's good to see that some of the online whiteboard folks are now making more anonymization possible. For example, I used Miro yesterday, and in Miro, you can click onto a post-it and see who wrote it and when. Yeah. And if it's been modified by someone else, that's also recorded there as well. But I understand the reasoning behind that, but I understand in the latest version, they're going to switch that off so you can have real anonymous contribution.
Yeah.
One thing that we do there, for example, quite often is that if we use an online whiteboard in our work and that gets presented outside in any point, we don't give anyone access to the board. They only get the PDF, because in the PDF, you can't do that and you can't see. Yeah, so we can be more anonymous and so on. So we go through these boards and we will remove names here and there and stuff like this, unless somebody wants to put the name on something, which is fine, of course, and say, I stand for this.
Yeah.
But it's an extra process level, certainly.
I know when we've caught up many times before, but applied improvisation is something yourself and Renata, you're part of the network.
Yes.
And in my understanding of applied improvisation, I've done it in stage when I've tried my hand at acting and stuff. It's a very physical thing. It's a very, you're feeding off each other. You're feeding off that other person's expression, and their energy is very transferable. And I know you're using a lot of the methods online. Yeah. Talk me through what that looks like on an online experience.
Sure. So what we're talking about here is applied improvisation, which is taking the principles of improvisation, which normally happens on stage in things like whose line is it anyway, and so on. Or in the jazz club, when musicians improvise, or when Keith Jarrett goes on stage with his piano, or even on the sporting field, one of those strange non-round balls bounces the wrong way. The teams have to improvise really fast. And you take those principles and you apply them to non-traditional contexts. So it could be training, it could be design, but it could be conflict resolution, leadership, all things like this. And this is a community where I actually met Renatus, one of my main collaborators now. The Applied Improvisation Network is this fabulous group of people who are doing this. That's what they're interested in. Some are performers, some are not performers, but they luckily had already been concentrating on this online application of this for some years, even before COVID came along. Yeah. I think a lot of that was about respect for the planet and trying to not fly around the world too much when I don't really need to, and seeing what can we do through a screen. And so they're the guys, for example, who taught me half of the basic Zoom hacks that we're all using now. Like make everybody a co-host so they can move between rooms themselves, having a lobby area and stuff like this. All these little hacks using the Zoom function to mask people whose cameras are off, so we can switch off a camera to kind of step into the background or switch on the camera to come in again. And we don't see lots and lots of black boxes, but we see just the people whose cameras are on. All these little things make a huge difference. So we've been able to adapt a lot of this work, a lot of these tools into our work on screen. And we use this to prepare people to get the mindsets right for design and to make sort of, if you like, learning points about things like divergent and convergent activities or whatever. But we also use it actually within the design process to work on prototypes, to work on ideation, on research and stuff like this. A lot of theatrical methods coming in there. So apart from improvisation, other kinds of applied theater sort of flowing into that. And it works really well. It works really well. It is very important, I think, to remember that these video channels will tend to make us focus even more on talking, on everything becoming verbal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And our cultures are already very much shaped by the more verbal people, whether that's written or spoken language. In the words of Bob Geldof, our priests, poets, and politicians who run the world, they are wordsmiths. Yeah. But there are people in organizations who have incredible insights and amazing knowledge who are not strong. They're not word strong, as a Viking might say. Yeah. But they can show you something. They can build you something. They can walk you through something. Yeah. And as we are more and more on screen, it's really important to find ways to activate that side of the knowledge and the wisdom in the room and not just have it all through words. Doing, not talking, has been our motto at the Jam for years. Not against talking, but we think the balance needs to shift.
Yeah. It's really hard because as a facilitator, your responsibility is to make people feel comfortable and to support them in feeling respected enough to come out and say those things.
I think that's half the response. One of the methods that we use most in our work is one called investigative rehearsal, which is a very long, chunky name. But it's a design version of a thing called forum theater or theater of the oppressed, which was invented by a Brazilian theater maker called Augusto Boal. And this is a kind of theater where the audience steps into the scene and takes over roles. Yeah. So we use this as a design method for research, for ideation, prototyping, and implementation. And the model, the person, the facilitator in Boal's work is often called the difficultator, because part of your job there is to say, I don't think that's good enough.
Yeah.
Do you really think that we've proved this now? Is that wishful thinking? This actually is going to work? Yeah.
Yeah.
And this needs to be done obviously with respect and trust as well. And you probably shouldn't start this way, but challenging people is very important as a facilitator, because it's very easy for a group to get into a bubble and to be in love with their own ideas and to see the world in a way that suits the solution they prepared for it. And sometimes bursting that bubble can be really important. Another word that Boal uses, or that community uses for that role of the facilitator, is the joker. And I love that term.
Yeah.
So it's like joker in a pack of cards. And that's a beautiful image, if you like, because first of all, the joker in the pack of cards is based on the medieval fool, the jester, if you like, which is a facilitation role. The jester, who was often a person with extreme physical challenges or somebody from a very humble background, was one of the only people in the court who could say the truth, because they were never going to be king. Yeah, that was very clear about, because their personality, and they could say the truth and they could make it acceptable because they were able to package it in humor. And there are actually historical accounts of, I forget which French king it was, but the French had lost a horrible naval battle against the British and nobody was able to tell the king. You know, it was one of those sort of Stalin situations where nobody dared tell the guy he's going to flip out that they'd lost, you know, half an army, until the jester, I forget his name, told the king that the French knights were so brave they'd all jumped into the sea to fight the English. Something like this is really, really important. And the joker in the pack of cards also, and this is so, so important in facilitation, the joker can be a 2 or a 3 or a 4 or a 5 or a 6 or a 7 or a jack or a queen or a king or an ace. It can be anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in facilitation, we need to remember that we can vary our relative status. Yeah. We need to sometimes go down to eye level, to squat beside the table and say, hey guys, what's going on? I'm not really following. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes to stand in the middle and take a stand and say, guys, what's happening is not acceptable. Yeah. And vary between, if you like, the royalty and the lower numbers.
Yeah.
As we walk, yeah, relative status as we go through a workshop to help direct it towards a useful conclusion for everyone involved.
We do that in the real world, but how are you applying that in the online world? Because at the moment you've got the breakout rooms and you've got the kind of the primary state. Mm. And I struggle with this. You can jump in and jump out and kind of go, hey, everything okay in here? Then you've got that awkward 20 seconds where you're leaving. Yeah. Like I'm leaving the room and then you're joining another room. But how are you doing that? Is there anything that you're doing that you want to share?
I mean, some of it is still physical. So one of the things around status, relative status, is voice. Yeah. And generally, if you want to have a lower status, then you'll speak a little bit higher and you'll say quite a lot. And maybe you won't finish a sentence, you know, that will make you, I mean, I'm overplaying it now, obviously horribly, but that sort of shift to being,
unless you're having a moment.
There we go. To being a little bit conspiratorial and you know, lots of head movement and so on. That works really, really well to lower your relative status. Or you lower your voice and you say less. And you might even be a little bit quieter. Yeah. That's a thing you can do to raise your relative status when that's necessary or useful. I think in terms of those little asides, it's the availability of edge areas, to use your word again. Yeah. I mean, what are you doing in the breaks? Are you hanging out so they can come for a little conversation? Yeah. Maybe with some music on in the background that makes you feel a little bit more chill and a little bit less overheard. One of the reasons that we offer these open sessions generally at the Co-Creation School is that it means people who are in a serious session with us have an opportunity to pop in somewhere else and say, hey, by the way, last week, I don't know if you got it, but this happened. Yeah. And that's actually happened a few times. So it's another area. It's a side room, which is not even labeled as such, but it's the simplest offer of something going on. I do put a suit on the Zoom call sometimes. Maybe not a suit, but a jacket at least, or a collared shirt rather than a t-shirt. You can lean into the camera, lean out again. I mean, I have quite a nice camera here. The guys listening can't see that, but sometimes it's better to use the good old laptop camera just so your picture, everybody else's. You don't look like you're some sort of dominating high-tech expert with lots of money to spend on these things.
The one thing that I would say is audio is extremely important for me anyway, in particular, like when I'm listening for prolonged periods.
Yes.
And it can really irritate my ears in particular. I'm getting older and my ears are very sort of frail from years of bashing them in rehearsal rooms and playing guitars too loud. But I find if the audio of the speaker who I'm listening to isn't on point, coming and going, it's very difficult to maintain the attention of the attendees.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it is very difficult.
I know there's a couple of courses you're running on This Is Doing at the moment with Renatus. One of them's in September. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So these are what we call the Facilitation Fundamentals courses. There are a few other things we're doing, which are really exciting on This Is Doing as well. But the main one, I guess, people are looking at is that one. And what we've tried to do here is, looking back on our decades of facilitation experience, we've tried to boil that down. We've tried to say, what are the absolute fundamentals of this work? And myself and Renatus and our colleague Anna Kirabex. And I call this the Mr. Miyagi approach to facilitation. I don't know. Yeah. I guess the listeners are too young, but there was a movie once called The Karate Kid, There was a remake of it, which is, but the original is great. And this young guy is being bullied at school. Classic Daniel San, being bullied at school. And he has a Japanese neighbor who is a karate sensei, an elderly gentleman. And he gets this, the elderly gentleman agrees, Mr. Miyagi agrees to teach him karate. Yeah. So Daniel San goes over and he spends the first day painting Mr. Miyagi's fence.
Up and down.
He has to move his hand in a certain way with the brush. And he spends the second day waxing the car, wax on, wax off, moving his hand in a certain way. And he can't just do it anyway. It has to repeat these movements until late into the night. And the third day, he's sanding the deck. And at some point, he flips out and he says, I've come here to learn karate. And Mr. Miyagi says, you are learning karate. And he says, BS, I've been sanding the deck and I've been painting the wall and wax on, wax off. And Mr. Miyagi throws a punch at him. Yeah. And he automatically moves his hand in the wax off position and blocks the punch. And he throws a couple of kicks and it's the sanding movements to block the kicks. And he says, you are learning karate. You're learning the essential moves.
Yeah.
And when the mindset. And when we come back later, we'll put that together. But you need to get these essentials right first. So these fundamentals, I think, are super useful for a beginner because they will be the building blocks, like wax on, wax off, of everything you do after that. Everything after that fits into these frameworks. Or if you're an experienced facilitator, they will connect things for you and show you further options. We say they are presence, flow, and structure. So it's about how you put your courses, your sessions together, whether they be training courses or design sessions. It's about how you stand and move and speak as a presenter. And it's about when you take control and when you let go. So that's freedom within structure. And we have some great sessions. Each one is a full half day where we do lots of activities around this. We do lots of applied improv stuff and really explore these three things to get your wax on and your wax off.
It's primarily focused on the online medium.
Well, we do it online. And so what we try and do is we're always trying to have sort of two or three levels of learning happening at once. So if you've seen this method before, we at least try and show it to you in a new way. And if you know that way of doing it, maybe the way we're presenting it online or the way we're using the online platform is interesting to you as well. So we try to use everything we know about online training, and that's certainly part of what you'll take away. But because these are fundamentals, we genuinely believe they apply everywhere. They apply whether you're online or offline, and you adapt it to the situation you're in.
Adam, great chatting with you.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
So there you have it. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisishcd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. Now, if you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network, and also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.